Stan Turton, Reel 4.
You can manage it. Anyway, I want to tell you about something which I found rather amusing. And this came to mind to me, brought back to mind to me, about, in fact, a couple of years ago. Terry Wogan, as you know, he comes on the radio in the morning, and I find him quite amusing. Anyway, he was doing this programme a couple of years ago, and this guy talked about the fact that during the war, the ships used to get flour. Well, actually, it was white flour, bleached, and it was white, because we got white bread. And this flour came into the ship in hundredweight sacks. Now, the routine was this, that the paymaster or one of his minions would come on the upper deck, and two guys would come, and with two big round drums, pans if you like, you know, about 3 feet across and 2 feet deep. And on top of one, he would put a sieve that covered it all. And the idea was to cut open the top of the bag and empty it carefully into the container. It's like a big bath, through the sieve, so that it was all emptied in. Now, this guy stated on the radio to Terry Wogan, he said, now, the routine was this, that if there were two dead mice in that sack, that flour was fit for human consumption. And if there were three dead mice found in it, it was not fit for human consumption and was to be thrown over the side, ditched, because it was unfit to eat. Now, Terry Wogan laughed his socks off at this, and as God's my judge, I can assure you it was the plain, unvarnished truth. That is actually what used to happen. The guy used to come up, and that was what actually happened. They tipped up the sack of flour into it, and if there was only two mice in it, God help me, they used it. If three, it got ditched. You know, he couldn't get over this, Terry Wogan, and I laughed my hat off when I heard it again, because it was so funny and it was so true, and I've actually stood and watched it happen, this sort of thing. And they used to, the flour tasted all right, and there was nothing wrong with it in actual fact, but, you know, from the flour mill, you're always going to get mice. You can't help not do. It's one of the hazards of milling. I like to wager today that, you know, lots of flour sold, and it's had this sort of contamination, although they don't know it, you know. And it's like other things. I mean, it might not sound very pleasant, but when it was hot, you know, in the med and any place like that, you could get lots and lots of cockroaches in the ship, particularly an old ship. And in fact, not particularly an old ship, any ship. They breed very fast. And we used to have cockroach drives, you know. And the bloke who captured the most number of cockroaches in a given time, he got a prize. You know, he got 50 cigarettes given and stuff like that. And people find it incredible now that when I turn around and tell them that you'd have to dig the cockroaches out of your bread. You know, that they used to have a bread locker on the end of the mess, with all the mess traps in it, and that was the bread locker underneath, and they were all kept spotlessly clean. It had to be, but I can assure you that used to happen. You would have to dig cockroaches out of the bed sometimes. Very unpleasant, I know, but it's either that or go without, and if you're hungry, you'll not go without for long, I'll tell you. But it's laughable, I suppose, really. I've laughed many a time. And it's that's a notice, they say, isn't it? I used to enjoy Malta, you know. It used to be a very interesting place. I found it so anyway, but then again, I've always been interested from a kid in anything historical. I like to find out its origins and stuff like that, and I used to thoroughly enjoy going on trips outside the letter, which is the main place, as you know, and away from the docks. But you see, there again, the same old thing used to happen. We're very suspicious of English matlows anyway, and believe it or not, whilst the bravery of the Maltese is beyond question, hence the George Cross the island got, the fact was, in those days, there was always a faction in Malta who were against the Brits, by very nature of the fact they were getting the bejesus knocked out of them by the bombers. And they wanted to negotiate a peace, but of course the British wouldn't, and the rest of the Maltese didn't want to. So that got nowhere. But you could go outside in areas, and they were very suspicious of you. They wouldn't talk to you, only under sufferance and stuff like that. And they certainly didn't want to know you if you made any attempt to talk to a girl of any sort. They, good God. In fact, I must tell you this. While I've got some left on this tape, it just come to my mind. I might have mentioned this before about one of my oppos, Ronnie Lewis. He was a bit of a card, was Ron, believe me. And he, I think I mentioned it about this business having started courting this girl from this pub on the dockside. I think it was up Sleema Creek. And this pub was called the Dun Cow. And the mother owned this pub, little bar. And there was two or three girls. I think two were sisters and one was a cousin. And being, you know, Latin looking, they're quite nice looking girls. Anyway, Taff had got his eye on this girl, and he used to go in there, and he got a bit amorous, I think, one night after he'd had a drink. And he used to have a beautiful golden ring his mother had given him with three lover's knots on it. And in a weak man moment, he gave this girl this ring this night. And when he came back aboard, he said to me, with three sheets to the ring, he said, you know, he said, I didn't talk to her giving her that ring. I said, well, you have done it, you Welsh idiot, you know. And sure enough, the next morning, about 11 o'clock. We looks over the side and there's the Dicer being rowed across by the boatman, and the mother sat in it with the daughter and the priest, no less, Father Flatat. And up the ladder he came, onto the quarterdeck, and Taffy is having a blue fit. What am I going to do? I said, well, keep calm. Just wait and see what happens. Right, they sent for him, and the gist of it was that apparently he was promised to marry this young lady. Is this correct? Well, yes and no, sir. What do you mean, yes and no? Well, I don't remember. And all this business. Well, anyway, why have you given her this ring if you're not serious about her? The girl has got it into her head that you'll propose to her, proposing marriage, and all this bit, you know, blah, blah, blah. And this is the commander who, I would imagine, he could barely keep his face straight. Anyway, Taffy biked off on this sort of thing, and he hummed me hard, and they said, well, I'll give you time to think things out. As soon as these Maltese people had left the ship, it was sent for again, told to pack his bag and hammock, and he was put on draft up to Naples as fast as his little legs could carry him. Got the first ship up to Naples, and we picked him up later on. And he got away with it that way. But they had no intentions of letting him marry this girl like that. But he lost his beautiful ring, which was worth quite a bit, and he never got over that. But, it was an idiot, but it was a lovable rogue and an idiot as well. But I thought I'd just mention it while we're passing. In Malta, there's a street by the name, the proper name is Straight Street. S-T-R-A-I-T, that sort of straight. It's been there since the year dot, and it's known all over the world, or was known all over the world by sailors as the gut. You ask any sailor that's a real saltwater sailor, has he ever been down the gut in Malta, and he'll start to crack out laughing. Now, it comprises of, it did in those days, of shoulder to shoulder, the full length of it, of pubs. And I'm told that pre-war, a lot of these pubs had got over the bar the crest of one particular ship, or a particular ship. And if pre-war, when they all wore proper cap tallies, your cap tally didn't match that over the bar, they wouldn't serve you. And this tree is known throughout the Navy and other navies as the place to go down for some fun. And it was full, this place, you know. I mean, a lot of it got knocked about and bombed during the war, but it was still operational. And they used to have bar girls in who would tout for drinks and all this business. And it was always patrolled by the either the naval police or the marines. And you could bet your sweet life that any night you liked, when it got round to somewhere around about 9 o'clock, it was time for a bit of a fracas. And you always got this happen down Straight Street, down the gut, and it was taken as read. And you could understand the fact that the Maltese didn't want to know about Jack and his shore-going customs, you know. But we've had some real laughable times in these places, you know. You couldn't help but laugh at some of the antics of some of the lads, you know. And I thought I'd just mention it, you know, because it was all part of the history and the colourful background of the RN as it was then. I don't know about now. Of course, there isn't the same number of ships, and of course Malta is no longer a naval base for the Royal Navy. It belonged to some obscure Mediterranean country who shall be nameless, you know, and all things like that. But as I say, I thought I'd mention that also in passing. Sometimes when you're working part of ship, as I said, if it was in harbour and harbour routine, you could get jobs where really it was a bit of a loaf, you know. And I remember we had a stoker aboard us in both the Spartan and Aurora. I can't think of his name, but he was as strong as an ox. He wasn't a big lad, but he was very, very strong. Excuse me. And he got ahead like a bullet. And one day he's working on the right in the bottom of the boiler room on the plates. Don't know what he was doing, doesn't matter. But right up on the top grating at the top of the boilers, there was an engine room tiffy working with a big wheel spanner who was opening the valve. And this spanner slipped out of his hand, and it bounced off the grating and down into the bottom, where it hit this guy bang on top of the head. He hadn't got his hat on or anything. Well, there was a dead silence. Everybody expected him to buckle at the knees and be out cold. And he just staggered a minute, shook his head, and he looked up at this tiffy, and the tiffy's looking down at him, and he said, "If you do that again, I'll kill you, you bastard." He hadn't even got a coat on his head, actually. This is what we found. So it was so hard, and how he hit him and didn't cut him or fracture his skull, I just couldn't understand it at all. But there were some rum so-and-sos we had at times, you know. But as I said earlier, Spartan herself wasn't a happy ship at all. And it's sad, really, because she was a lovely ship, really, as far as ships go. Anyway, I will move on a little and just tell you briefly about, we went up to a little place called, before we did Anzio, to for supplies, etc., just outside on the Bay of Naples, called Castellammare. And there's hardly anything there at Castellammare. And this particular day, I don't know how it worked out, but anyway, I was on shore leave. I got a little bit of shore time. and there was an Italian lady on the jetty selling fruit. Well, we weren't allowed to buy fruit raw, you know. We had to have it properly washed in some form of disinfectant. It would give you dysentery and all sorts of things, not being used to it, you know. Anyway, this guy I was with, he could patter a little bit of Italian. And he got talking to her, and she was a woman, I should think, in middle age. And, you know, we nattered, and he was trying to ask her whereabouts she lived, had they got a farm, and apparently they had. And the upshot of it was, she said, if you want to come up, I'll show you, you know, I'll show it you. So we did. And we walked up about a mile up this road, this track, and took us into this farmhouse. And it was a typical, lovely farmhouse, really, you know, bare kitchen with a big old-fashioned table in the centre and stone flags on the floor. And they were just going to eat, you know. I found out later it was spaghetti bolognese, but I didn't know it. I didn't know what it was then. Anyway, she invited us to sit down and eat some. Well, rather than be rude and refuse, we said we would. A bit sceptically, because the one thing, we didn't want to take it from them, because I don't think they got so much. But when it turned out, they got plenty of that. They brought it in on a huge dish and plonked it in the middle of the table, and everybody dug in and helped themselves. But what I'm about to tell you was that they had a young daughter of about 11, she looked. Can't really tell with them. And the old man came round, and he smacked a pewter mug in front of each of us, and he topped it up out of a big jug with vino, you know, and he sent the little girl round with this jug to keep topping us up. And all of a sudden my mate said, hey, look at that kid. We looked across, and everybody's eating and what have you, and she's knocking this vino back like it's going out of fashion. And he said, I've watched her. He says, that's the second one of those she's downed. But little did we realise that the Italians don't drink like we do. They didn't certainly drink wine like that. That wine she was drinking, that kid, was let down half by water. So a volume of alcohol that she was taking in was a much, much less than what we were taking in. But we couldn't manage no more than two of these mugs. In fact, we were rocking on two. I couldn't take any more anyway. But I've never forgotten that kid, because it looked just like, you know, the vino we were drinking. And I found out later, as I say, it was to be let down, which I'm glad it was. She'd have been an alcoholic by the time she was 20-odd. But it just shows you the difference in eating and drinking habits. You know, in Taranto, as I said earlier, we made friends with a family up there, and I got on quite well with them, and I felt very sorry for them, in actual fact. They got so very little, the Italian population. And they worked, the dockies, they worked for a pittance in the dockyard. And they were working on our ships as well, you know. But the only thing is, I suppose it's fair to say, we didn't start the war, they did. And but they used to say they were very much against the Germans. Now, whether this was true of all of them, I don't know. Personally, I don't think it was. I think the you know, they had a lot of support, although you could talk to individual Italians, and they were frightened of the Germans. They were frightened of the German troops when they were walking the town, and things like that. They you know, they didn't like them at all. Walking about and having to serve them. Obviously, a lot of them had fraternised with them, but they reckoned on that they hadn't, you know. Anyway, Pat, as time went on, we're still in January 44, and as I said, we were going to go up to Anzio, which we didn't know that it was to be an attempt at a landing. And we went up with this convoy, and you're quite apprehensive with this. There's so many, you know, there's so much tension. You knew there was something going up. You knew you were going to take part in an operation, but you didn't know what. He didn't even know it was going to be a landing. The troops knew they were going somewhere, but us as ordinary ship's company, we had no idea what we were going to do at all. And our job was fire support to the troops. And whether you know it or not, or whatever, such ships as Spartan were invaluable to the army at that time. We were doing this fire support, and it's fair to say that we did the Germans, once the action started, we did the Germans an awful lot of damage, both on troop concentrations and, of course, on tank formations and everything else to do with it. And, you know, we certainly pulled our weight up there. And it was hectic, can we say that? We were doing this and the other and different jobs, you know, fire support jobs as it's known as. And I know many, many months later after Anzio and we were away from it, we got talking to some army blokes in, I think it was, I don't know really, somewhere down lower down the country. And they've been up on the beachhead, and they've got nothing but admiration for the accuracy of our gunfire. They realised when we told them that we're from this ship, and they were full of praise. They said, you know, our gunnery was dropping salvos and entire salvos within a relative few yards of their positions to strafe the Germans. And as I said, they've got nothing but admiration for the ship. She did a good job up there, there's no doubt about it. And I think it's fair also to say that when you're in circumstances like that, you tend to forget your grievances. You haven't time to start moaning about this and the other, because you're too busy trying to look after yourself and follow your orders, you know, and that sort of thing. And in my opinion, it was, well, like bad luck that she got hit as she did. I will say this before I finish. Many years after the war, I should think about 10 years, I have an older brother, he's just recently died actually, but at the time I'm speaking of, it would be in the 50s. And one day, I'd never spoken to him much about this. One day he said to me, what time was it when you went in the water? I said, well, it must have been about just turned 7. Oh, I said, why? He said, well, that's rather strange. I said, what's strange about it? He says, I saw all this, you know. I said, did you? He said, well, yeah. He said, I was at work and I had this premonition and vision, if you like. And he said, I saw you climb this ladder and get out the ship. He said, but I got the time wrong. And then it dawned on me, he hadn't got the time wrong at all. There was a 2-hour time difference between UK time and the time of Italy. So he truly had some form of vision, but he saw everything to do with it, everything. And it's a funny thing, I didn't realise, he is a bit psychic, because at times I've had these psychic things, and whenever I've been in danger, I seem to get this sort of thing, like a premonition. And I never felt safe in Spartan, you know. I never ever felt comfortable as I did later on in Aurora. I didn't feel comfy, I didn't feel safe or anything. I can't describe it any more than that, Pat, but only quite recently I've had ample evidence that premonitions do work. I hope you don't mind me talking about this, but it does work. Matter of fact, the Sunday following New Year, I had the most narrowest escape of a car accident I've ever had. A bloke had a heart attack coming down this nasty bend up out in the country road. His all four wheels left the car, and it was a matter of feet in front of me, a split second earlier, and he would have hit me. Both myself and my wife would have been gunners. And I had this little premonition that somebody up there likes me very, very much. And I've got to say it, Pat, I think they do. So I hope you don't mind me talking like that. Anyway, I'm rather thirsty and dry now, and I'm going to pack up, and I hope this tape is okay for you, and you enjoy listening to it, Pat. And thank you once again.